Zvuk misli.
Podcast Instituta za filozofiju i društvenu teoriju.
Dobrodošli u još jednu epizodu Zvuka misli. Danas u gostima imamo profesora Hans-Georga Müllera, kao i našeg Milana Uroševića sa instituta, tako da ovaj razgovor će teći na engleskom jeziku, tako da odmah ćemo preći na engleski. I wish you a good day. Welcome to the Sound of Thoughts podcast. Our today's guest is Professor Hans-Georg Müller. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Macau. He's the author of many books that cover very diverse topics, from Taoism to system theory, and from morals to phenomena of the digital world. At the same time, Hans-Georg Müller is a very influential YouTuber in the niche of philosophy-related YouTube channels with over 60,000 followers. So yeah, that's some kind of a scope in which we will. That we can expect. Also, we have with us Milan Urošević from the Institute of Philosophy and Social Theory from Belgrade, our colleague. So yeah, we can start the chat. Welcome, Professor Müller. It's an honor to have you here. It's great.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Hello, zdravo, Milane.
Bolje vas našao.
Hvala. Okay. So yeah, maybe the best way to start our conversation today is like by having by drawing some kind of a biographème, a biographème that Roland Barthes was calling that, a biographème, the writing of a life, you know, not a biography but a biographème, an image of your career and of your thought and like biographically seen together. So maybe in that sense, I would like to ask you, maybe we can start by superposing academia on the one side and internet on the other. I think that fits the given right. image right. Quite well, at least at the given at the present moment. So Hans-Georg, what does it mean to do philosophy in academia nowadays, and what on YouTube on the internet?
Right. So you were talking about my biography. My background is I'm an academic philosopher, and have been for several decades by now. And as you mentioned, since a few years, maybe 2 years or so, yeah. I also started a YouTube channel, and for whatever reason, that was also somewhat successful. So you're right, I have like a foot both in the academic philosophy mm-hmm. and in, well, social philosophy on social media, right? And as you mentioned, these are two very different social systems in the terminology of systems theory, mm-hmm. And they function very differently. And so my experience in these two realms are also very different. Speaking briefly about academic philosophy, I think nowadays we think that that the academic, as I like to call it, the academic industry, is kind of a natural home of philosophy, because most philosophers who actually live by doing philosophy do so within the academic system. But then, of course, historically, that's completely not true, right? It's highly contingent, because most philosophers in the past, there was no academic industry, there was no academic system in the modern sense. So most philosophy was definitely not something that, you know, for the most part of human history was had its home in academic philosophy. That's a very new thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also quite telling that most, or at least many, of the most interesting and in one way or another most successful philosophers, even of the 19th and 20th and 21st century, are not really academic philosophers, right? You think about people, whatever, like in the 19th century, like Marx and Kierkegaard, and in the 20th century, like Sartre, and even people like Wittgenstein, you know, okay, he had an academic position, but was very uneasy and kind of tried to avoid it as much as he could. And then even other philosophers like whatever, Derrida or Rorty, who are influential to my thought, they were academics, but they were not really in academic philosophy, and they were kind of discriminated against by academic philosophy.
Sure.
And then, you know, closer to home here, whatever, Zizek, right? I mean, he's also somehow an academic philosopher, but academic philosophy doesn't really take Zizek seriously, right? So he's much more in the public sphere and a public intellect than actually an academic philosopher.
It depends where still.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, I think the point is rather...
It's not a homogeneous field, like we still...
No, but the people like whom are most successful in academic philosophy are often completely unknown outside of academic philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I doubt that they will have a very kind of strong impact on the history of philosophy. They're very successful in the system or in the academic industry because of the way it functions. But we have now a highly functional differentiated society. That's a Luhmannian systems theory term. I don't think we have time in this interview to get into that. But clearly there's a strong...
Sure we do. When it comes to Niklas Luhmann, we can.
Yeah.
We will spare some time.
But these systems are kind of, you know, self-referential. They refer to themselves, and that you succeed in one system makes it actually kind of unlikely that you succeed in another one because of the self-referentiality of the of the distinct systems, which have their, you know, different organizations, which have in many, if it's a really different systems, they also have very different code, right? And we talked about this a little bit before the interview, right? We now see that in philosophy, for instance, that analytic philosophy is becoming basically sort of, spreading like a wildfire in academic philosophy. And we just talked about here at the university, which is, I was informed, your philosophy department at the University of Belgrade is like overwhelmingly analytic. And even in Germany, that's now the case. I mean, I left Germany a long time ago, more than 20 years ago. Yes. And at that time, analytic philosophy was a fringe field in academic philosophy in Germany. From what I know, it's now the mainstream. So that's a major change, right? In traditional strongholds of continental philosophy and big philosophical systems, and that's all gone, right? And instead, and because analytic philosophy, the way it communicates, lends itself very well to the academic industry, right? You produce a lot of journal articles that are all reference a lot of other articles. They are short, and then you develop this kind of self-referential discourse that is tied into a certain publication industry, and that is within the academic industry. It's a sub-industry within the academic industry. It creates this, as I'm saying it now for several times, this kind of self-referential communicational, let's say, feedback loop. That's where we are. We have these kind of professional experts in these kind of very narrow, very specified, operating with very standardized codes and a very kind of highly developed jargon. That's what's taking place in academic philosophy. And as I said at the beginning, to go back to this, even though if you're in this, you think maybe, yeah, that's just the way to do philosophy because I get paid for it. I'm a philosopher. I'm a professional philosopher, right? But of course, historically, that's totally not the case, right? And most of the traditional philosophical texts, including very recent ones, like I guess even Niklas Luhmann's texts, which are not that old. I think they would be very difficult to publish Niklas Luhmann now. If he would now apply for a position, I think he would have no chance with the stuff he's written to succeed in academic system, because you know, he would have to publish all these articles and have to go all through all these review processes and so forth. And I don't think, for instance, his works lend themselves very well to that.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask is just like, okay, with that factor of professionalization, industrialization of like philosophy and research work, maybe in general, we see maybe the direct economic interests of some parts or something like that. But what I would like to ask you is what do you see as the consequences, like political consequences, or maybe epistemological consequences of this switch, of this change that is now for some decades in...
Well, I guess we have two somewhat contradictory tendencies. We already talked about this again previously a little bit.
Just continue.
And it seems to be a similar situation here in Serbia as in many other countries, that the rise of analytic philosophy and the professionalization and industrialization depoliticizes philosophy. There is a theory, there's been a book, I forgot the title, that was published in, I think, 1970s or so, a hypothesis that the kind of push towards analytic philosophy in the USA was on purpose in order to depoliticize, in context with the McCarthy era, the humanities and specifically philosophy. So we see, I think, very strongly on the one hand that tendency. But on the other hand, which is contradictory, and that's another topic we maybe get into later, we see the rise of wokeism, which is, of course, highly political in the West. And that is something that we not only see in philosophy, we see it throughout the humanities, and not only throughout the humanities, but basically throughout all fields. So we have at the same time a kind of making philosophy harmless by making it an expert, very narrow, basically impenetrable from anywhere else discourse. So if you know, make everyone into a into an analytic philosopher, you basically neutralize academic philosophy as a politically dangerous, it's no longer politically dangerous, right? Let them do whatever they do. And so you have these people doing this stuff and they're no longer a danger. But on the other hand, we see that academia in general, and that includes philosophy, I don't think philosophy is at the forefront of this necessarily. We also still have the academic industry in a, you know, I'm using this somewhat metaphorically, in the function that already kind of Kant criticized philosophy as the handmaiden of theology, right? So philosophers produce some form of rationalization, legitimization, justification of certain religious dogmatic creeds that have a very important social function in basically justifying how society in general operates and justifying that society, that to itself, right? So basically, again, philosophy had to provide, when it was functioning as the handmaiden of theology, a major function it has was to provide basically to rationalize and to provide like an intellectual foundation for the leading dogmatic and religious discourse.
Yeah, but still philosophers, it seems that they managed in many cases, like take just Descartes, for example, like to subvert this kind of thing. Because, yeah, okay, the meditations, the Cartesian meditations are
I totally disagree with that. Because, I mean, Descartes too, it's about in the end, it's about... You know, if you look at theism as the wokeism of early modernity and previously the Middle Ages, then Descartes was doing precisely that. He was kind of woke in his times because he also, in order to express his philosophy, I mean, his most famous book, The Meditations, like the most part of it is about is about saying that God exists.
Yeah, of course, but that's what I'm not negating that. That's more certainly the case, and he's embracing the certitude. You know, he's pushing the radical doubt thing in order to embrace certitude in the end.
Exactly.
We all agree he's coming back into that vicious circle of belief and trust. That's okay, and he's proving that. But still, that made some kind of a leap, and I don't think that this kind of wokeism could produce like anything epistemologically valuable or whatever, because, you know, like the first time is a tragedy, a second time is a farce, you know? It's a bit of that kind of system, you know? It was tragical that Descartes was doing that, but people who are like woke people are not tragical, they're just, it's just very dangerous and ridiculous in the same time, if you ask me. But anyway,
I think the parallel, I mean, I don't know exactly what you're getting at. Of course, Descartes was not just woke, right? And his main project was not a woke project. His main project was, you know, to reflect on issues of certainty, yeah, and to establish basically, which was a main kind of pursuit of philosophy at the time, the concern with certainty. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's basically the thing. And that's not in itself woke, but he had to package it in a woke context in order to be able to publish it. And that is what I was, to go back to the initial question. And of course, now in academia, most of the people are just concerned with the packaging, because it's what you have to do in order to establish an academic career. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, just as Descartes also had, his main project was not woke, I'm sure there are many still academic philosophers whose main project is not woke, who have other interesting ideas. But in order and that's very similar to Descartes, if they're academic philosophers, they basically have to operate within the civil religious framework.
Sure. But my intention wasn't to advocate Descartes or anything similar. Just I wanted to push you to the question, if in this kind of, if there is some hope in the end, can we, in packing the package the way the system is pushing you to pack it, do we have a chance to slip a small surprise in there? There is something that you wouldn't recognize maybe in the first moment, but it's still there.
And of course.
Are there people who are still, is there some subversive potential in academia today, or we are doomed? nothing. What do you think? Yeah, just think that, and then we will pass
the subversive YouTube. Potential is there. Yeah. But again, I think of wokeism very much in terms of a civil religion. And it almost it comes ever more fundamentalist. And so it is increasingly difficult and rare to do subversive stuff within the academic system. I think it's now much more difficult and much more rare than it was at the beginning of my academic career just a few decades ago. Yeah. So that is a problem. Still, many people are subversive, and subversion is always happening. So it's just more difficult and more rare, and maybe more subtle. But I think it's always happening. At the beginning, we still didn't talk about the second part of the initial question, where you were asking me to basically comment on the second leg of my biography. Yeah. The internet persona, my internet profile as a philosopher.
Yeah.
And I just want to say maybe two or three things about that. As I said, it functions very differently. Mm-hmm. Main thing is you have to, get attention. When you introduced me at the beginning, you mentioned the number of subscribers I have, which is, of course, signaling that this is somehow an important channel, simply because of the number of the subscribers is relatively high.
Yes.
Right? It has nothing to do with the contents of my channel, right? Yeah. But we see there how much, these kind of data identifying, the profile of a channel and so forth. And So, for instance, in my case, the way how my channel became relatively popular is like a complete coincidence, and had to do is now I'm, you know, it's basically an algorithmic function. So if you succeed online, if you succeed in social media, of course that is very much an algorithmic effect, right? And so we also, like in the channel, me and my PhD student who produces the channel, that's just the two of us, we also have to, of course, then think about if we do whatever, cover this topic and whatever, what images we show, how we edit the video, will this, you know, generate enough views, right? So we're constantly under that pressure, basically. In order to keep the channel alive, you have to produce videos that generate views and that generate attention, which of course is also very a very problematic thing.
Yeah. Some kind of a YouTube age index, you know?
Of course, of course, yeah. But it's more fun for me personally than the academic thing, okay, and okay. It aligns much better with my interests than the All academic right. system. So far, I mean, I only did this for a few years, but I think it's really very good that this, by coincidence, happened to me. Mm-hmm. It's a strike of luck, mm-hmm. which, by the way, also brings me here. We wouldn't have this interview if that algorithmic coincidence wouldn't have made my channel mm-hmm. somewhat known. So, and this is just one example of many examples. Mm-hmm. That through the YouTube channel, I get a much more interesting feedback, and I meet many more interesting people. Mm-hmm. I produce, to use a notion that is now used by the German sociologist Rosa, but anyways, resonance. Resonance is much uh-huh. higher and much more intense and much more enjoyable for me. Mm-hmm. Well, Rosa sure. thinks that's, but that's a completely different topic.
Yes.
So I don't want to go there. So this resonance, I experience a resonance through my online channel that I miss very much in the academic industry.
Mm-hmm.
I missed in the academic industry. So in this mm-hmm. way, I personally actually prefer my YouTube work mm-hmm. over my kind of conventional academic work, which I still have to continue because I'm also, I'm a worker within the academic industry. All my mm-hmm. income mm-hmm. is generated 100%. I don't make any money from the channel, and I cannot.
Mm-hmm.
Is generated through my position within the academic industry. So I sort of have to credit my employer mm-hmm. that they allow me to do this, because I spend a lot of time for that, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have to fulfill, the regular now academic publication criteria and, of course, the teaching criteria mm-hmm. in order to keep my job. But what I'm trying to say is I'm lucky that I have, financial stability because I have, a permanent job, more or less permanent. And that enables me to do this other part that I, in many ways, enjoy more and in a wider sense also find more meaningful
mm-hmm.
than the narrow professional academic stuff that I'm still obliged to continue to do.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Maybe we can now see the more of how that could, like, maybe those circumstances, how do they affect the content of, of your intellectual efforts, and how do they shape it differently? Maybe we could say, I don't know if you would agree, that many of YouTube philosophy videos could be considered as vulgarization in a good sense, okay, of philosophy. That's maybe a some kind of a common thread.
Right.
But what is for you that good vulgarization of philosophical ideas? And yeah, maybe we can start with that.
Yeah.
What's a good vulgarization for you?
I basically do two things on my channels. Channel, and one thing is the what you call the vulgarization, and I also think use this term here in a positive, not in a no. It's normally used negatively. So, but I try to. That's the motto of some of my videos. Clarity creates ease. So. Mm-hmm. Unlike some traditions within continental philosophy, yeah. Both in France
especially
and in Germany, they don't really focus on clarity. and the point was basically to make yourself, through the more hermetic you make yourself, the more kind of prestige that you can generate through that. Mm. I like clarity a lot. And so... that's how I also read philosophy myself, that I try to basically transform unclarity, I don't know if that's the right English word, mm-hmm. but into clarity.
Obscurity.
Obscurity, thank you very much. To transform obscurity into clarity. That's mm-hmm. basically, as a philosophical reader, my main strategy. And because I'm also have to teach as part of being a worker in the mm-hmm. academic industry, I do this in my class, and I enjoy that. And several of the academic books I wrote are basically working on that very line, transforming obscurity into clarity. And I think that's helpful, and it's enjoyable, and I like it, and I do it also on my channel. And but these videos are not the most successful videos. I like it. I now have a series on media theory, which I very much enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. There, my principle, again, is transform obscurity into clarity. These generate maybe now, like, whatever, 20,000 views or so at this point, each of the videos there. But then the more successful videos, which some of them have more than 100,000 views, so it's a big difference, are not really primarily about that. But that's a different form of vulgarization, a second type of vulgarization mm-hmm. in the positive sense, that I try to, or I do, apply my own philosophical conceptual framework. Mm-hmm. Maybe we get to talk about that later. Basically, sure. The idea of profelicity.
Mm. That's why Milan is here. Yeah, also.
To apply that to concrete things that are happening, concrete issues that are currently discussed, to whatever to issues and events and problems that are in the public discourse, let's say, like this. Mm-hmm. And that's also a different kind of vulgarization that I find very important mm-hmm. and also enjoyable. And this is, how is this a vulgarization? It's a vulgarization because it concretizes the conceptual framework. So instead of just having what you're doing like in academic philosophy, you just basically work within a very kind of often very abstract mm-hmm. Theoretical framework. Here in on social media, I can actually test and apply and play with mm-hmm. The application of these concepts, and I also find that enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can just now go to the to those concepts of yours that you were mentioning. So maybe Milan.
The way that Andrea and I came to an agreement that I will be participating because, of course, I got acquainted with your work and your ideas through your YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. I've been following it maybe since the beginning. So, as Andrea said, maybe we can move on to your actually the conceptual framework through which you are working. So, you are developing, we can say, the idea of a new paradigm of identity,
right.
Basically, the way that you call it the identity technology.
Exactly.
Yes. So, in line with Trilling's work, right, is his paradigms of sincerity and then authenticity, you develop a new paradigm you call profilicity.
Right.
So maybe can you tell us a bit more about how you envision that paradigm and also some things about its history and the social factors that maybe you think brought it, that influenced its emergence.
Right. So let me try to very briefly define these three terms. So sincerity, authenticity, and profilicity. As you said, I understand these as identity technologies. That's, of course, a metaphor. What is an identity technology? An identity is basic. An identity technology is, let's say, in a wider sense, a cultural method in order to establish a sense of identity, which is central for individuals, for human individuals, that they have a sense of who they are individually, but also, of course, collectively, right? We have to, I think it's a very basic, let's say, existential, foundational, and they're also social need in order for both humans and society to function, that we have a sense of identity of ourselves, of others, and of our, let's say, communities. I think that there are basically three major technologies for doing this. The first is sincerity, and sincerity means, as you said, goes back to Lionel Trilling, a sincere commitment to roles. So in traditional societies, I mean, Serbia also still has like rural parts and so forth, and So it basically means a sincere commitment, for instance, to the gender role you have in a family, whatever, as wife or mother or as husband and so forth. But then also other like social roles, professional roles, religious roles, whatever. And in traditional societies, you would basically commit to a combination of these roles, and they were more or less already predetermined when you are born, right? You're born in a specific gender, you're born in a specific stratum of society, you're born into a specific whatever location and so forth, you're born into a specific community. And so you build a sense of identity by basically identifying in the form of sincere commitment to these roles that you have, and in this way, through this sincere commitment, a sense of identity is being produced, and in this way both individuals and society can function. And then in modernity, the idea is we have the rise of individualism, Luhmann's terminology, we have functional differentiation, we have industrialization, we have urbanization and all these things, we have the and this means that the traditional society breaks apart, becomes much more dynamic. Now basically the old role continuity and the role framework becomes more and more obsolete. And that also means the old technology really doesn't really work anymore in the modern world when you're like an individual trying to make a career and so forth, and you know, you have to move out and you have to. So then we see this complete basically switch. Now you build identity by finding your true self. So that's authenticity. Mm-hmm. You build your sense of selfhood by what I like to call the pursuit of originality. So instead of orientation to the outside role, now the direction of orientation switches to the inside, and you're seeking your true self. And this kind of Identity technology also, of course, relates to such things as I said many times, individualism, but then also how we see, you know, person. The whole human rights discourse is basically also built upon this. That now we regard a person and the human even human rights, so to speak, rest on this assumption people have a specific identity which is very unique to themselves, and that everything has to be done to protect this identity of them. And political discourse and political structures are supposed to basically affirm this notion of authenticity and enable people to become authentic. That becomes the major narrative in authenticity. So the pursuit of original individuality and of originality in general. And then the third, of course, my main hypothesis is that this age of authenticity, as the philosopher Charles Taylor called it, is coming to an end, and that we have already entered a new age of what I call profilicity. And profilicity means shaping your identity through the creation of profiles. What are profiles? Profiles are, created and then publicly presented identities that then get validated in social validation, feedback groups. This is, of course, most obvious nowadays on social media, where we have, you know, we create different profiles on different platforms. Mm-hmm. And we need multiple profiles in our life. I need a different profile, for instance, in the academic industry, mm-hmm. than I need as a YouTuber. And yeah. I'm constantly curating these profiles, but I also need other profiles, whatever, in my private life, for instance, mm-hmm. right? I have these may be to whatever my family members. I need specific profiles. I need to curate it, but my friends and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to learn to build these multiple profiles that mm-hmm. are very dynamic. That's how they are different from roles. They are not like fixed. Mm-hmm. And they also don't really have like some sort of organic overlap as the traditional roles had. There is not, they are kind of schizophrenic, if you want, right? We have to learn to develop and create be truly invested in these highly contingent and highly diverse profiles, and we have a multitude of them. Mm-hmm. That's how I see profilicity, and we have to learn that in order to be able to, you know, exist as individuals, to build a sense of identity, but also specifically in order to function in society. Mm-hmm. We recognize one another on the basis of our mutual profiles.
So that's really similar to the way that Frederick Jameson talks about identity in the postmodern age, I would say. So we can say sincerity is like a paradigm for the pre-modern age, the authenticity for the modern, and this is for the postmodern.
Right. We have to also understand that the model is somewhat Hegelian, these three steps, in the sense that the previous technologies don't disappear. They still continue to exist, and we still can operate sincerely, and many people do, and authentically, and I'm still very much a child of authenticity. Mm-hmm. So we use them in combination with one another. But it's just like in the age of profilicity, the profilicity becomes, let's say, the most advanced and the most important technology that we use. Just like with actual technologies, we also use not just digital technologies. We're still using hammers and hammer a nail into a wall from time to time. So we have to do that as well. And in the same way, profilicity doesn't completely erase the previous, but just like it's a Hegelian Aufhebung, mm-hmm. A Hegelian lifting. So the other, yeah. The other technologies are still available, and they're still there. And I also think that the kind of dialectical contradictions within each technology give rise to the birth of the next technology.
Mm-hmm. What I would like to see is that. If you were mentioning that some kind of that there is some kind of sublation happening, like the Aufhebung happening in there, so if we remember and I think Alain Badiou is like underlining that somewhere, like they were how the Russians understood dialectics, like the Stalinist Russians, how they understood dialectics, it was thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, okay?
Right.
And then there is the other way how Maoists understood dialectics is that you have a whole one that is by the dialectical process then split into some right. kind of obverse idea. I don't know how do you situate yourself in those two understandings of dialectical progression, but what I wanted to ask actually is that, like, do we have an underlying maybe principle in all of those three categories, like sincerity, authenticity, and then profilicity? Do you think that there is isn't the human being as human beings, were we always like multiple personas in the sense, like you're talking about roles, and how do you see that roles like differ from profiles? Because still, in the age of sincerity or authenticity or profilicity, take it as you want, you still had those multiple roles that were organized in some different senses. So how the profile is different from the social roles that we were building up our identities on before?
Right. Again, you bring up a number of things. I will just address what I consider to be like two main points you brought up. Yeah. The first one is, I don't think there is no such thing as an essential identity. Right, mm-hmm. I think human existence is sure. incongruent, dissonant, and completely contingent. So identity is a necessary construct. There is no such thing actually on an ontological level of mm-hmm. identity. We are not identical with ourselves, right? And we have very dimensions, like again going back to Luma, whatever, we have our, you know, we have our bodies, they operate somehow and they look somehow, and then we have our minds and we have the social, you know, situation that we're born into. And these are all kind of diverse things, right? We somehow nevertheless have to construct the notion of being one. Right. Whereas, in fact, we are a very complex, dissonant, incongruent, let's say, assemblage of mm-hmm. all kinds of functions and contingencies. Mm-hmm. Identity is basically a counterfactual social and psychological construct. Mm. And therefore, we need this technology. That doesn't mean that identity is unreal. Right. I mean, this table is also a construct, right? It didn't exist before it was made. But once all these kind of incongruent and dissonant parts that constitute it are kind of shaped through a certain, in this case, actual technology mm-hmm. into a table and are given like some form of identity, something similar we do in the realm of identity, mm-hmm. right? Just as tables are basically also incongruent and dissonant and contingent things that need to be constructed because they do not exist as such, right? Mm-hmm. Similarly, identity is also something that is being constructed. So none of the identity technologies is more or less right, mm-hmm. right? They all function within specific social contexts where they actually work. And then if society changes, the technology becomes obsolete and you need a new technology mm-hmm. to do the job. So that's one thing. Now, you were asking about the difference between sincerity and profilicity, because...
Or authenticity and profilicity. Or like well, how I mean, do profilicity stands out as something different from the two previous ones that...
Well, as I said before, the difference between sincerity and profilicity is the difference between roles and profiles. Traditional roles mm-hmm. were stable, right? The kind of expectations regarding specific roles, let's say the role of mother or the role of whatever, a nun or the role of... a soldier. These were fixed roles, and it was very, and the roles wouldn't change, right? And you could live up by sincere commitment to it, and then and the roles were basically already predetermined. You were born into them. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Now that is no longer the case. We do no longer consider, bring us back to wokeism, mm-hmm. that you're born female and thereby you have a certain role that you need to live up to and that you need to identify with. No mm-hmm. matter which gender you're born with, mm-hmm. We don't use gender roles anymore, right? We do the opposite, right? We think that gender roles are something that is that needs to be overcome. Right, traditional gender roles. Mm-hmm. Right,
if we say we,
I mean Europeans society. Yeah, yeah. World society in general. Mm-hmm. I think, of course, some societies, whatever, Islamic societies, Chinese societies, sincerity is still very, very strong. Right. But generally,
that's a huge chunk of population.
Yes, of course, and I'm not denying that. But you see, very much in China. Also the overcoming of sincerity with profilicity.
Sure. In different ways, maybe that would be also
right. Yeah, the difference is that China doesn't grapple with authenticity. In China, the main thing is the fight between sincerity and profilicity, whereas in Europe and in North America, it's clearly the conflict between authenticity, the contradiction, to go back to the Hegelian Marxist term, between authenticity and profilicity. Mm-hmm. And we see this transition. So basically the problem of profilicity in very much sincerity-based societies like China is that profilicity is regarded as insincere. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Western societies, mm-hmm. profilicity is regarded as inauthentic. Because we judge it from the perspective of authenticity, from the technology of authenticity. That's why the critique of profilicity is predominantly always, complaining about its lack of authenticity. Yeah. So I think we're now witnessed in the 17th and 18th century, we witnessed this clash between sincerity and authenticity, and it was all about people rebelling against the old roles and the conformity with roles, and many novels is about and even philosophy is all about how can we overcome sincerity and reach authenticity, how can we transition from one to one from one to the other. And now I think the clash is clearly, because we're still at the beginning, I guess, of this transition from authenticity to profilicity in some way. The emphasis is on we're not so sure. We are afraid of becoming inauthentic. Mm-hmm. We are afraid of admitting that we're already profilic.
And we have lived through the whole postmodernism, like it has come to the end, and we are not not still like getting over it.
the grips. The authenticity semantic, the grip of the authenticity semantic, even though I think it's again counterfactual. The age of authenticity is basically over, but
yeah,
we cling on to the old idea, and that's, if I may say so, why I think my concept of profilicity is somehow important, because we lack a conceptual language of profilicity. Basically, the values we have, the philosophical concepts, the political concepts, I mentioned human rights and so forth, are all part of the larger semantics of authenticity. So I really think a major problem, and this is, you know, how I really like to see my work, that I try to work towards establishing a conceptual vocabulary of the age of profilicity that we're already living in, so that we can finally find the right vocabulary to actually make sense of ourselves, because the authenticity vocabulary no longer really makes sense.
Yeah, so you're doing kind of a Foucauldian reflection on our current predicament, on the contemporary, as he would say, in a way.
Right.
Or trying to establish what are the paradigms we are currently living in. So maybe we can move on to some, you mentioned that some of your videos have more, some have less views.
Right.
I would say probably that those who have more views are those who are more, let's say, tied to political topics.
Of course,
polemical ones. Yeah. They probably have a lot of interesting comments and people give their opinions. So maybe one of the things that you talk about in your videos, which I think is also very important, is what you call profile politics, meaning that you also use your conceptual framework of profilicity to understand current political clashes, predicaments. Some would say that for maybe more than a decade now, in political science and social science, there's been a lot of talk of right-wing populism. Some would say maybe that those they're often analyzed as a kind of re-traditionalization, using your language, maybe a kind of trying to go back to the age of sincerity, you know, evoking the nation, traditional gender roles, religion, race, etc. But when you talk about it, you actually usually present those political actors as actually using profilicity, like Donald Trump, maybe.
Of course.
What can you tell us about how profilicity actually impacted our political life?
I think politics are generally clearly profilic, and that's also already been going on for many decades. And it basically means that, you know, we move on from basically, which is somehow still grounded in sincerity, the ideology-based politics, right? Which was traditionally the case where you have different ideologies and then political parties or political movements represent these like completely often, or not completely, but still significantly different ideological visions. And the political contest is a contest between different ideologies. Now, through the rise of democracy, liberal democracy, through the rise of many other things, technological innovations, and of course also functional differentiation in society, the political system, again, I would have to go into Luhmann, which would be too complex, becomes basically also a self-referential political system. And now what is really becoming important is, especially if you have these liberal democracies and you have election processes, is that basically the person that it's, we have a profile contest. And you already have this, like, famously between J.F. Kennedy and Nixon, the TV debate at the early 1960s, where people realized this was really who was coming across as the nicer person somehow, not as a nicer person, but as the more attractive profile through the TV staging of the election.
That's contest. Similar to how Baudrillard characterized when Reagan was elected.
Of course,
he talked about that,
yes.
How it was actually. somehow symptomatic how an actor became a politician, and how actually supporting Reagan was a kind of a gesture making you popular in a way.
Of course, exactly. And so, of course, we have many actors who became very successful in politics, and some of the current leaders also have that background. Politicians have to engage in a second order observation. It's just like they have to observe like in the economy, we have the market conditions, and if you're on the stock market, you have to constantly observe the market conditions and then position yourself accordingly. Mm-hmm. And the same thing in the political context. You have to construct a profile, and then you have to constantly, again, this is so different from the roles, you have to constantly create your profile because the future is always open, which was not the case in Sincerity. And then you have to adjust your profile and make sure that you're seen as being seen in a positive way, right? So that's what the most important thing is. You always have to gorge and observe. You have to engage in second order observation, as you have to observe how others observe, and in this way, and how you're being observed by others, you have to really be good at second order observation, and then in accordance with second order observation, constantly create a profile. And so political contests are basically nowadays just profile contests. And that's very similar, to give another more concrete example, to branding, right? And so, of course, it's even the same people who, direct marketing campaigns for companies, they also get employed by politicians and become their election campaign.
Do polls strategists. And focus groups.
Yes, and it's all about this. And you constantly, whatever you do, not just during election time, but the politicians are constantly engaged in a mutual profile contest. Mm-hmm. Just as corporations and the economy, you're in a constant kind of branding contest, and this is how politics function. And of course, it's how Donald Trump functions, but not just only Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Also, of course, on the left, it's exactly the same. There is no difference regarding to that. And actually, Naomi Klein, in her very good book, No Logo, which has also a lot of to do with profilicity. A logo is basically profilicity. She's basically describing profilicity and then is arguing against it because she also shares still the authenticity bias. but anyways, she says that Obama was the first super brand in politics, right?
Yeah.
And we can also say in my language, he was the first super profile in politics, right? So it really doesn't really matter if you're on the left or on the right. But I mean, Trump was so obvious and still is so obviously profilic that it's kind of much more obvious, whereas the others kind of but even Trump, anyways, I think I
mm-hmm. so in that sense that you were mentioning, that we have like the same like profilicity phenomenon happening on the right as well as on the left, do you claim this is some kind of a universal condition actually that we're living?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So in that sense, how this changes the status of critique itself in our contemporary world, you know? Like have we gone with profilicity in what some thinkers called the post critical era, or your stance is different? Like, what's your take on that?
I don't think that, as I said earlier, but it's important to highlight this, that profilicity is in any way worse than authenticity, nor do I think that it is in any essential way better. So, as I said, like, these identities are always created. There is not one right or wrong way to construct it. Either it works or doesn't, right? And I think in order to be critical, first of all, we need to understand profilicity, and we need to in order to come up with good critiques of it. Critique, of course, has a double meaning. Like, first of all, in the Kantian sense, good analysis of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's very important. And then this good analysis, of course, also will allow us to critique Profelicity, mm-hmm. in the sense to better understand its pathologies, its contradictions, its dangers, and so forth. That doesn't mean that we're, it's similar to how whatever, like we have a medication and then we understand the side effects and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think critique can have a similar function. I think it's very important, that's also a Lumanian idea, that critique should also needs to understand that it operates within the same, that it's not outside but inside society, that it basically describes the conditions and critically analyzes the conditions, again similarly to Kant, under which itself operates. So mm-hmm. a critique is always an immanent critique. Mm-hmm. I do not think that there is something like a transcendent critique. I do not think mm-hmm. that this is possible, and I think critique should fess up to its imminent position. Mm-hmm. Does that address the question?
Sure, it does. In that imminent position, is that imminent position somehow resembling?
That's, for instance, sorry to interrupt you, right?
Yeah.
I think a main criticism of Profelicity and also of profile politics or so is, we need to return to the age of authenticity, and we have to kind of make politics more authentic, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is absurd, right? Because mm-hmm. it just doesn't understand how politics function, and it doesn't understand how society functions. Yeah. So rather than kind of having this absurd desire to return from a profilic politics to an authentic politics, mm-hmm. we should understand and be very critical mm-hmm. of how politics under profilicity works. But we shouldn't have the authenticity, return to authenticity demand, because it's completely illusionary.
Yeah, sure. It seems that we are still in that regime of civil religion that you were mentioning, like, be it in the form of authenticity or in the form of profilicity or even in the form of sincerity, like maybe if we remember Rousseau explaining, like giving an imagery of the civil religion is like people planting a tree and then just dancing around it, you know, and that must be some kind of the same process for the tree modes of our identity building, be it the first, the second, or your term, the profilicity. But is there some kind of way of like going out from the? And I'm asking you that because I feel that we are stuck with that wokeism problem also, you know? Is there some kind of way out of this autoreferential kind of civil religion dancing around the tree that we have planted ourselves, or because you were saying, yeah, the critique is imminent, and how do we deconstruct that then without, because we don't want to go back to the stage of nature, you know, we don't want to destruct, like just pure destruction of everything, you know, we will finish in horrible violence, but is there some kind of way to, like, let's get it like this. How do we critique wokeism and how do we escape what was before called political correctness without being, let's say, violent, even symbolically speaking? I don't know. I don't know. That wasn't the question. It was a few theses like that, just to provoke you to in what sense I would like to hear you speaking. You know.
Sure. So first, very briefly about the connection between wokeism and profilicity, right? Mm-hmm. We can see, I think, exactly. very clearly that I already referred to this in the academic industry, but you also have it in politics, you have it strongly in advertising, you even have it in sports, mm-hmm. that a very, very central way of curating a profile, a successful profile, is through, in one way or another, incorporating an wokeism into your profile, mm-hmm. right? If you want to be a successful politician, a good way to curate your profile is to send woke signals and integrate woke elements into your profile. And the same is definitely the case for academics. But again, as I said, in, for instance, Germany, even all the professional football clubs have to be somehow woke, right? Mm-hmm. And create a woke profile. Mm-hmm. So it's wokeism is the connection between wokeism and profilicity is that it is a very strong profile enhancer. Right, but you can also do it in America, like Trump or so, you can also create an anti-woke profile. Mm-hmm. That's also possible. Not so much in Germany, but I guess more so in the United States and probably also in Serbia to some extent. Mm. Sure. Now, what is wokeism? So wokeism, as I understand it, is mm-hmm. the civil religion of our times. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not the, it's only in America they speak of the culture wars, right? The conservatives, the alt-right or whatsoever. That's, I think, one, let's say, denomination, one faith. And the other wing is that's a right wing, and the left wing is wokeism. Right. Mm-hmm. But they are basically all grounded in the overarching civil religion tied to individualism and tied to, the Western narrative of the 19th and 20th century. Now, so these are two denominations of the same overarching civil religion, and wokeism is now the, at least in Europe and increasingly globally, the dominating form of that civil religion. Okay, mm-hmm. It's not the only one; it's just a sub form of the overarching civil religion. But it's not the only one, but it's a dominating one, increasingly dominating. It's basically a kind of a dogmatic, moralistic, but at the same time secular, if you want, ideological, semantical set of, they often speak of values and so forth, but it's basically a semantics, mm-hmm. right? A very powerful semantics that, just like religion, provides something like the feeling of moral superiority, which is very important. The feeling, mm-hmm. it justifies all kinds of, for instance, political action. It's a very effective political weapon and so forth. Mm-hmm. Many of the things that, of course, just like traditional religions, that the contents of wokeism are fine, right? Just as whatever Christianity was all about love, and there's nothing wrong with love. So wokeism is about whatever, social justice and these kinds of things, which are, of course, all fine. So my critique of wokeism is not about the contents of wokeism. It's about the form and the use of wokeism as a civil religion. And there are several problems attached to it that are similar to there's a multitude of problems attached to wokeism. One has been outlined by the anti-woke left, which I very much sympathize with, the traditional left. Mm-hmm. Namely that wokeism basically sidelines traditional leftist core issues like that are class-related, economically related, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it's basically become a tool of hyper-capitalism. That seems to be very obvious to me. So it's basically a fake leftism. It's used to actually kill the left, right? I think it's not really left, and we can see this very clearly in North America, where basically Bernie Sanders, who is also kind of woke because you have to be woke, but certainly less woke than Biden, cannot become the presidential candidate because he still claims to be a socialist, and that's not, you know, that. And we have a similar thing in the UK with Jeremy Corbyn, who was also woke because you have to be woke, but less woke than the others, who are like 100% woke. And then but perhaps even more importantly on the grassroots level, right, you have now the young people and so forth who naturally kind of tend to the left, and they are all concerned with these identity issues and so forth, and the class issues and the economic issues are kind of completely forgotten. So if you want to be a conspiracy theorist, I'm just saying this jokingly, I'm not. You can say wokeism was like an invention of the global elites in order to suppress the traditional form of class struggle. That's a criticism that's not original that you hear by anti-woke leftists who feel disenfranchised by the rise of wokeism. So I think that's a serious problem, that the focus on class issues and economy on the critique of capitalism is kind of silenced by wokeism, or to the contrary, wokeism is clearly appropriated by hyper-capitalism as a kind of religious, civil religious adornment of the practice of hyper-capitalism, just as Christian religion was used in order to, very much from the beginning to provide an ideological and moralistic and transcendent framework for that justified capitalism. So that's one of the major problems. Another problem, as I said, is the highly moralistic nature of wokeism, which is actually not really critical. It's highly judgmental, right? Everything we see about cancel culture and so forth, it's basically a highly moralistic discourse and semantics that suppresses basically critical thinking because you are constantly forced to basically repeat and a certain set of prefigured items of faith. And if you don't do that, if you do something else that isn't even against in content of the wokeist, you're seeing as not really a good kind of practitioner of wokeism, and that can hurt your profile. And that's why there is a very strong obsession with basically just repeating and insisting of the dogmas of wokeism. So it's highly dogmatic, and thereby it doesn't allow for the development of critique, and it doesn't allow for the development of creative thinking. Let me put it like this, because of its highly dogmatic nature. So that's a real problem. And again, then thirdly, it's kind of also used in geopolitical context. I could go on and enumerate more things, but we don't have that much time. So I've maybe end here. I think it's also like Christianity was used for imperialism and colonialism. It's also used very much, by America, by the EU. For basically adorning and ornamenting and morally justifying what in effect are basically geopolitical power struggles that are also very strong, both geopolitical and economic power struggles. So they camouflage these struggles. So by being stuck in the woke semantics, we don't really get a good analysis of the actual political and economic power struggles that are going on.
Yeah, so it's an ideological instrumentalization of woke discourse, basically. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so then we can maybe move on to exactly one of the woke problems, which are tied to the woke phenomena, and that's the phenomena of gender.
Right.
So currently, gender is probably in the one of the highly contested topics, highly contested phenomena, which is used as a kind of a divide, a touchstone for the political divide, basically, usually on the quote-unquote left and the right in various countries of the Western world. It is also one of the elements of the so-called culture war.
Right.
So my question would be, how would you actually connect the contemporary problem of gender and how it is being developed with your ideas of identity technologies and the move to the paradigm of prophylicity, and maybe also tell us how your work could actually contribute to a kind of new understanding of gender that would maybe transcend the contemporary struggles over it, the way the struggles over how we understand gender.
Right. I think gender is obviously very central to all identity technologies, because gender is a very, you know, core element of identity, gender and sexuality. So it was already very close for, very, very important, very central to sincerity, right? Because roles are some of the most important roles were gender roles. I mentioned some of them before, like whatever, mother and a father and these kind of gender roles. So in the family, for instance. So gender is a very important, let's say, tool in the tool case of identity technologies. It's a very, very big tool for in the tool case of identity technologies. And I think we have a reemergence now of this tool, gender, in under the conditions of prophylicity. So since we no longer can orient ourselves to traditional roles in shaping of our identity, we just don't want, you know, to be the traditional man or the traditional woman. That really doesn't work in order to shape a sense of our identity. We now also use gender as a primary tool in order to construct and create our profile. And that's something that society is learning today. And I think that's the underlying reason for why, for instance, transgender is now becoming such an issue. As you mentioned, it's now a very hot political issue. But I think the underlying reason is the transition from an orientation towards roles to an orientation towards profiles. So a very important part of the shift towards prophylicity is now that we learn as a society to basically recreate gender as a profile. And because we don't have the traditional binary roles, we now have an emergence on all of all these kinds of genders, which allow to basically create and be truly invested in a gender identity beyond roles, after roles. We lost the capacity to identify, to gender ourselves in terms of gender roles. And we now do it in profiles. And again, that's a big difference between sincerity and prophylicity. In sincerity, you had a few fixed gender roles, often binary. And now these roles are gone. And we have this multiplicity of profiles. And that leads to a multiplication and diversification of gender under conditions of prophylicity. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the underlying problem. Now, as you said, this, for whatever reason, is highly politicized now. But I think what my major theoretical interest, that's my most important task. I want to provide the vocabulary, the concept of prophylicity. Mm-hmm. For instance, very importantly to understand what's happening right now with gender and to make sense of that. I think we need the notion of prophylicity to understand what's happening to gender identification right now. If we only operate with the old vocabulary, we're kind of not capable of understanding of what we are now doing with regard to gender. Gender And also the phenomenon of transgender is, I think, very clearly an effect and has to be understood as in the context of the transition towards profilicity. And we've moved on from gender roles to gender profiles. So that's a core hypothesis that I have, and I think it's an important point to make.
So one of my questions is, of course, we began talking about academia and academic philosophy, and of course we can't escape that completely. Now, as being someone who is very interested in theory and various contemporary theories, when trying to apply your ideas of profilicity to gender, it seems to me to be very close to Judith Butler's idea of gender as a performative.
Yeah, so it's just unfortunately that Judith Butler doesn't use the notion of profilicity. Otherwise, that would help her a lot. Yes.
Yeah. So,
but you're right. I'm strongly influenced by her work.
So, do you think that maybe because when you were now talking about gender, it seems to me that you were talking about roles and then profiles, but it seems that you've stepped over the authenticity part. And it seems to me that when various people, especially online, of course, talk about gender today, it actually, to me, it mostly seems as talking from the discourse of authenticity, talking about gender as a kind of internal essence that you have.
Absolutely, yes. This internal essence is not something that is exclusive to authenticity. Mm-hmm. It's also in sincerity, you know, that was like, you know. But anyways, you're absolutely right. We still conceive and describe ourselves. This is another symptom of what I said earlier, that we're still stuck with the semantics of authenticity and therefore are incapable of understanding what we're already doing under the conditions of profilicity. And you see this very strongly in gender, where you have this we have this gender metaphysics that actually predates authenticity, but that is expressed in terms of authenticity. That people say that, you know, why do we have to, you know, embrace transgender? Because we want to enable these people to be their true and authentic self, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the main authenticity paradigm.
Yeah, but
right?
this paradigm is, I suppose, or I hope, that this paradigm is like born in the public discourse, that actually if you, maybe, I suppose, I don't know, if you ask people who are like engaged in gender change themselves, I'm not so sure that they will say that they are seeking their authentic selves.
Well, many do.
Yeah, probably.
I think the intelligent ones, like ContraPoints, I made the video about her recently, don't. They reject gender metaphysics.
That's what
but
I see.
Many
also
do because they have to. Because they have to, in order, for instance, to get political and medical rights, right, Eva? You have to, in the struggle of the transgender people, it is for them rhetorically essential that they use this kind of authenticity vocabulary and narrative because this brings them political credit. But of course, I, like ContraPoint and like Judith Butler, completely reject gender metaphysics, and I think it's entirely self-contradictory. But nevertheless, it's still the vocabulary and the semantics from the age of authenticity that kind of is still dominating, even though we're all, it's a different and a concretization of what I said earlier. We're already living in profilicity, it's obvious, right? And people like ContraPoints understand this. Transgender people who affirm, basically, in other words, affirm that they live their gender in the form of a profile, but most of them don't. Many of them, at least, don't, because we still lack a social vocabulary of profilicity, and we're dominated by the vocabulary of authenticity. And I think that causes all kinds of problems.
Yes. Yes, maybe this would be actually a good moment to close our conversation with your latest latest theoretical interest, we are eagerly looking forward to more of your contents, like videos, but also about also books. We thank you very much. So just follow the Hans Georg's profile, the Carefree Wandering, and thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Milan, also. It was very nice, and see you online in our respective profiles.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.